One of the worst things you can do to children is isolate them from death. From very early on, children should be exposed to death. And it does the opposite of what people think. I think it gave them peace. Maybe it gave them a little fear, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. A sense of, wow, what I do on this earth matters.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families.
Today, we're with Father Peter Cavanaugh. He was raised in a missionary and musical family and shaped by authors like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton. He found in the Orthodox Church a continuity with the apostolic tradition that answered his search for truth. Now he serves as the rector at St. Benedict Orthodox Church in Wichita Falls, Texas. He and his wife, Zoe, are raising 4 children, and he is the founder of the Ave Maria Farm. Benjamin Lida has over 20 years of experience teaching and leading in all kinds of school settings. He holds a Master of Humanities and Master of Theological Studies. He is the founder of Scriptorium Writing, and Benjamin and his wife have 6 children. And my name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you, Tim.
My pleasure.
Father Peter, why don't you tell us a little bit about your family?
My family and I, we've lived in northern Texas for about 10 years. And of course, like every other family, we're endeavoring day by day to learn how we can best blossom as a Christian family. And it's very confusing. There's a lot of questions that everyone has to ask and a lot of trials and a lot of messiness. But the most beautiful discoveries that we've had have all taken place in the context of our farm. And I grew up in the Shenandoah area in Virginia, in a log home, gardening, and mostly either running around and climbing trees or reading books. And I didn't grow up farming, but I grew up with literature in that context that developed sort of a romantic idea of getting closer to nature and living more simply. And when we were sent to Texas, and after a few years of getting settled into our parish life, we purchased some land. That was several years ago, and now we have about 40 acres, and we've been growing a community on that land. So there are currently 4 homes and 3 tiny homes that we've built, all within those 40 acres. And the fruit of our labor has just been beautiful. So what's the whole point of it and why are we doing this? I think I want to begin by saying, growing up in a very Christian home, but in a home where many of my siblings have ended up becoming atheists, and just exploring truth elsewhere, looking for reason and meaning in life outside of the church, I found myself for years questioning, you know, what does it take to nurture a faith in Christ? Is it a matter of apologetics? Is it a matter of reading the right things or going to the right college? Or what's the crux of the problem of our times? And I'm completely convinced that one of the main reasons people have lost faith is we've lost contact with reality. Mm-hmm. God has made creation. God and his logos are woven all throughout creation. And when you spend time in creation, in the present moment, enjoying it, cherishing it, learning leisure, as opposed to just entertainment that helps you to escape from reality, then you encounter the Spirit of God. And so my wife and I have been very intentional at getting our children out into reality. We don't have any television. My children have never even seen a video game or any of the those devices. And what's so beautiful is they don't miss anything. So when I was younger, I always said I wanted to raise my children playing with sticks and dirt. And people would laugh at me, right? But the reality is they're so happy with sticks and dirt. And we're so happy seeing them covered with sticks and dirt. And their imagination just takes place. It just blooms in this environment. But in addition to that, the other thing that we feel very passionate about is working as a family economy. Now, this term was influenced by Rory Grove's book, The Family Economy, which I think you have right here. I'm completely convinced that this is the best parenting and family-centered book out there right now. And it's very short, it's very simple. And for myself and so many others who've read it, it didn't give us something that we had never thought about, but it sort of crystallizes a vision that I think a lot of people are starting to experience, because so much of the direction that the modern world is taking in terms of education and rearing children doesn't seem right. It doesn't make sense. Children are separated from their parents. Everyone is isolated. Home is now a hotel. It's not a home anymore. No one really wants to come together and enjoy just quiet time around the table. And then we're sending off our kids. We're intentionally separating them. In fact, people, we've been taught in our culture that it's a virtue to let your children go as soon as you can. Get them away from you so that the world can raise them and they can get those values outside of home. And then we wonder why they don't come back afterwards.
Do you feel like in your family growing up, you feel like that was part of what occurred?
That's such a good question. So I grew up in a beautiful home with wonderful, very devout Christian parents. And I think they did a lot. I think they did the best they could with what they had, which I hope my kids can say about me. And they raised us in a very intentional family. We had dinner on the table every day. We prayed and read the Bible daily. And yet, as I've grown up, I've had to challenge myself to see, what do I love about my parents and how I grew up, and what do I want to do a little differently? And since becoming a father and beginning to homeschool, I've realized how incredible it is to be able to spend my days with my children, to live my life with my children. If there's anything that really hurts the most when I think about my childhood, my dad, who is such an incredible saintly Christian and a missionary, was very busy and was often gone. And I have a lot of memories of my father being distant. I knew he was doing good things and he was always there when he could. But I can think of a lot of experiences where I wish I had more day-to-day, one-on-one interaction. I wish we could do work together. And I think that's what was missing, because my dad had his work, his grown-up work, and I had my kid work. We weren't working together. Our worlds didn't really revolve in as concrete a way as I want it to. And so in our life, in our family, we've really made an effort to let our children know that they're participating in the food we eat, to let them feel that they're part of our life, that I don't have a life at work that's separate from them, but we, as much as we can, to a limited extent, but as much as possible, our worlds are overlapping. We're not raising our children to be kids. We're raising them to be noble adults, full human persons. And I think that's something also in our culture that we're missing. We segregate our children from everything. We give them different forms of worship. We give them different entertainments, but we're not respecting them as profound, divinely crafted persons, just as much of a person as I'm a person. And so it's been such a joy seeing how a family environment that focuses on being persons together, sharing our life together, working together, just brings so much meaning. And I'll tell you a story, just one example. I saw this and it made me so happy. So we all farm, the kids wake up right away and they do their chores and they don't grumble about it because it's their life. And I've become convinced of this. I heard someone say the other day that your children will do what you loved the most. And so they see we love the dinner table. We love sharing food together and we love working together and raising that food. So we have everything from chickens and pigs and goats and ducks and cows. And we have two dairy cows. And I started milking one cow, and my son, without me telling him, he started, our goat gave birth. And so he went and started milking the goat. And we're picking up, but we're going to drive down to Houston, 5 hours away. But we won a goat through 4-H, and he's going to milk because that's what you do. We're family. And the other day, he started, my nine-year-old son, he started making traps. He wanted to trap rabbits, and he was really upset. And he gets very deeply involved, emotional. He's a high emotional intelligence. And he came to me and said, I can't trap anything. And I said, it's okay. It's all right, son. He said, but I can't bring any food to the table. He was so upset, almost to tears. Well, he found a rabbit. He trapped it. And I had to leave. I had mass in 10 minutes, but he came with his rabbit. All right, son. So I was late to mass, but we had to process this rabbit, and we ate rabbit for dinner. And he, because the table has become the focal point of our home and our hospitality for our family, for our love for one another, and the preparing of the food, it's just become our joy. And that's become very much the mission of our homeschooling. Our homeschooling is not to raise children, to send them out so that they can go in the secular world and be isolated and do their own thing and live a successful, meaningless, secular life. Our mission is to nurture in their hearts a love for God and family and extended family, and a love to work hard to raise and to nurture that love for God within family, and to just be able to live a Eucharistic life, a life of cherishing what God gives us and giving thanks and sharing it.
So you said, that's fantastic. You said that working together. And as soon as you said that, the first thing that came to my mind was, for most people, we can assent to the idea of working together, but actually doing the working together seems very difficult. You know, I have a 2-year-old, I got a 6-year-old, I got a 10-year-old. I don't know how to work together. I mean, especially in our modern era, right? People work in front of a computer. We have devices, most people, right? So the farm is a great place to do that. And, you know, in this book, he says the same thing. The farm is a great place to do it. But it's more than the task. It's the attitude around working together. It's like the heart around working together. So I guess my question would be, did you ever find that a difficult transition, or did you feel like you saw what this should be in your own family from the get-go? And you're like, this is the way we're going.
It's definitely a growing process. Two things come to my mind. The first, and this is a reference to a book that Benjamin introduced me to, the Death of Christian Culture, I believe, and the Restoration of Christian Culture by John Senior.
Yeah.
And I often say this knowing that I might make people a little irritated, but he nails it. The beginning to a Christian life is smashing your television. And the reason I say that is, if you can get away from the screens and the distractions, which by definition, they make the world around us more dull, right? If you have all these fancy, you know, even, I mean, I think there's some good things and they're good movies, like Little House on the Prairie. Great, great TV series. Anne of Green Gables, yeah. You know, movies that have been inspiring, and Indiana Jones.
I was going to say, you said they make life more dull. I don't think I have the book here, but there's a book I read recently with Ezra. It's called Thoughts for Young Men by J.C. Rowell. And he has a small section in that book towards the last third where he goes through this idea of entertainments. And this was written in 1865. So, you know, no TVs, you know, maybe radio a little bit, mostly theaters, and I don't honestly know what else you do in 1865, but but those are the kind of things you do. I don't know. But he talks about entertainments, and he says that exact thing. He says that
there'd be little difficulty in arguing that they
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Give a false color to the sense of time, a false color to time, and they distract us from calm communion with God. And a few other things. I don't remember all the things he said in there, but very similar to what you just mentioned, this idea that they do distort, they give us a comparison for real life that is not actually real. They paint real life as something that doesn't really exist.
G.K. Chesterton once said in a letter about fairy tales, he said, "Fairy tales tell us that apples are gold to remind us that they are red, and that rivers are full of wine to remind us that they're full of water." And I believe what he's getting at is we have to learn to see this, the sublime in the small things. The entertainments, if you put a TV in front of a kid, they're going to go there because it draws you in. You don't have to think, and it shows all these huge flashing things. And the more you're entertained by that non-reality stimuli, the less you recognize how incredible a daffodil is, or a butterfly, or a ladybug. And so if we as parents can avoid, we all get distracted by certain things, but if we can shelter a home from things that are going to kill that natural propensity in us to see how absolutely profound sitting down at a table with someone you love and having a coffee or a glass of juice, that's incredible. I mean, this is a divine being in the image of God. And I've noticed this, it's really neat parenting, because you have these ideas before and you see it's true. The kids just love this. And kids naturally love these things. They love having tea time or having a picnic. And so I think the first thing that comes to mind there is trying to set aside the things that keep us from seeing how beautiful something simple is that's natural and wholesome. And then when you're in that environment where there's space and breath to just enjoy life with one another and the small, simple things, then I think it's a matter of just recognizing that persons are the goal, not the end product. It's messy. You know, my kids, my four-year-old, she's got more energy than I think if you gathered all the college students and the local university together, you know, she'd surpass them. I mean, so we're all outside. My kids are constantly making messes. She's always taking the chicken feed and dumping it around. And so it's messy. It's definitely, sometimes you have to be patient. But at the same time, just we talk about it, we share it. I very unapologetically tell my kids if they're hot, I'll say, "That's good. It's good for you. You know, I'm sweating. That's great." You know, and I try to inspire them to be excited about being a man, being a lady, or rising to the task. So again, it's not a matter of saying do this or else you're in trouble. It's the goal is to help them to see it as wonderful, or in the very least, an important part of our duty. One thing that really, this is another example of the importance of having animals or plants experiencing death. We had something happen to us that really changed the tone. And I hadn't thought about it until just now for quite some time, but we purchased our first four rabbits. We were really excited about raising rabbits. We're going to have a rabbit farm. Well, all the YouTube videos are somewhere up north where it doesn't get to 110 degrees. Kill rabbits. So rabbits are kind of part of our past for the most part. But we have four rabbits, and they were so excited. And one was sort of a foo-foo rabbit. I got my daughter just because it was cute. And well, one day, it was the first hot day, we hear a scream. Rabbits will scream every once in a while if they're really intensely scared or in pain. And we ran out there and all four were dead. Heat stroke, just like that. And it was devastating. We were all weeping. We were just really sad for a few days. It was hard. And after that, I told my kids, you know, we got more animals. And I said, all right, we've got to take care of these animals. If we don't, they're going to die. And then there were a few times early on, and a daughter, my son, you know, said, oh, I don't feel like doing my chores. I said, all right, the bird's going to die. And immediately they got up and they do their task, and they recognize that they are responsible for something meaningful. They're not just doing work because mom and dad say to do it and it's a chore but it's real. There's an importance to it. And also, like I said, they don't see it as a distraction from what they really want to do. They see it as part of life. It's not like, well, we're kids, we're supposed to play games, and now we got some chores to do. It's no, we're humans, and we're sharing the family together. And I think that's really important. And it's a struggle. You know, we all complain. I complain. You know, there are times when they grumble or they don't want to do certain things. Or one of my children is very absent-minded. And again, I think it takes a lot of patience and just trying to work with their gifts. My son is naturally inclined towards plants. He loves plants. And so I've tried to help him focus his time on that. And another daughter is just fascinated with horses. And so we started getting her horse riding lessons. And so we're struggling, you know, to help them to blossom where they can best find their strengths.
Have you guys found that the animal or the living being creature item, because we're connected to more technological devices, that we miss out on the reality of death a little bit?
Let me respond to that from an educational perspective. There's a whole lot that we study in literature and in science classes that gives kind of a false sense of knowledge. And a student who is only in a classroom and only indoors and only learns about life and death from literature and only learns about the biological processes from a textbook has, I believe, a false sense of knowledge, a false education. And I'm becoming more and more to embrace the idea that all knowledge is really experience. And experience on a farm. I mean, and this is nothing about you at all, but say that there was a family that only had a farm. I can imagine they would have an amazing education if all they had was a Bible in the house. Maybe they don't have shelves and shelves of books. Maybe they don't have the latest curriculum. Maybe they don't have online classes they can take. Maybe there's not a private or public school nearby they can go to. But the children were raised on that farm and have those experiences, and they have real knowledge about life and death, real knowledge about food and creation, real knowledge about nature and everything that goes along with that. And so speaking as somebody who doesn't have the farm, you know, the vision that Father Peter brings us is the vision I think many of us would love to, you know, enter into. But for a lot of people maybe listening to this, we live in cities, we live in suburbs, and we can't do the full thing. So what we do is we do whatever we can, right? So where my family's at is we go to Father Peter's farm.
As much as possible.
You sent your son there too.
Yeah, I did. No, but we do. Yeah. And this is actually, we're a little younger on this trail for this vision of life than I think you are and maybe even you, Tim. And so what we've done is we've tried to get out of the city just to start, just so there's some space for the kids to move around in. And we got a few chickens, and we've had chickens in a backyard in a suburb. So those are things, and rabbits too. We've had those in a suburb before as well. And even if you can't do that, you know, is any time you can get kids, you know, you go to the park in the city and there's a green field where they play soccer, but usually there's a creek along the side, but you notice kids don't want to play on the field. They want to do their free play down by the creek where things are natural, where things haven't been touched. So you take the kids to the park, but you don't take them to the playground, you take them to the creek. So there's different degrees by which we can give our children these experiences, even if we don't have access to, you know, the cows and the pigs and the chickens. Mm. But maybe you do. Maybe it's just a matter of going out of our way a bit. So one simple thing we've done, we don't have cows on our property, but there's a dairy about 15, 20 minutes from us. So we drive out to the dairy and we get the milk. It's raw milk straight from the cows. As my kids like to call it fresh milk. And they don't call the fresh milk at the store. That's not fresh milk to my kids. You know, but we get fresh milk and they see the cows. And there's always these calves around the corner. And they'll go and pet the noses of the calves and spend as much time with them as they can. So it's not that we are able to necessarily run the farm in our own property, but what we want to be able to do is give the children as many of those experiences as we can so they can have that contact with the reality, as you said. And I think you're right, Father. I think that it's the illusions created by media that you know something or that you've seen something when you haven't. You know, I just took my family just last week. We went to Yosemite in California, which I remember from my childhood as being one of the most beautiful places on earth. You know, and we've read books about it and they've seen pictures of it, but then they got there and it was, wow, Dad, they never dreamed it was anything like that. So there's no replacement for the actual experience. And for those of us who live, you know, not on farms, you know, there's other ways and we have to continually explore how to give those our children those experiences in measure.
Well, something you mentioned about the experience, I think, with the advent of technology that's more and more immersive,
yeah,
you engage more and more of your senses. And so you believe, it's not just that you think you've seen a picture, it's that you start to believe you've had the experience.
Yeah.
And I think to your point of missing out on reality, if I wear VR goggles and I hear the wind blowing in my ears while I'm standing on top of Mount Everest, my mind can believe I've been to Mount Everest. I've certainly never been to Mount Everest. And I've never experienced the dangers, the real dangers, the real opportunity for death to come my way that I would in a real life scenario where I can go down the creek and fall in. I can trip on a rock. I have mosquitoes biting me. And I miss out on the uncomfortable, but the real parts of that experience. So there's certainly something there. I don't know what happens, though. I think a lot of people are asking this question, what happens next with the advent of more and more technology that seems to more completely invade our minds and allow us to believe things that have actually never occurred?
I wonder, this is just off the cuff, I wonder how much contact with reality necessitates a certain amount of acceptance of danger. And we're very averse to putting our children in any kind of danger, any kind of risk at all. You know, our kids are, you know, padded rooms these days, you know. But for my kids to go down to the creek, you know, there's rattlesnakes down there. We have poison ivy down there. I think the dog got a bacterial infection in his ear, you know. So there's risks involved for them just to play in these places. That's not a playground provided by the city. Maybe that's necessary. There's bringing the rabbits home, right? There's the risk of death that the children can see. And we're just so averse to that.
So there's no question, as I see it, that virtual reality technology is demonic. And the reason is, so one might think, oh, well, some child, you know, this sounds great. You have a farm. How blessed you are. And what about the children in a skyscraper? And they never get it to go out. And so this gives them the possibility to hear and feel the waves of the beach and the salt of the sea. But the problem is, those weren't made by God. Those are man-made constructions. They're fakes. And even if you can fool the psyche, the soul knows the difference. You could have a robot we're probably not far from it, a robot that really could convince you that it'll be a good wife. But that wife can't love you. Christ's love will not pour through that because it's not an image of God, right? And so by escaping into these false, godless, and by godless, I mean empty of God,
yes,
literally.
Less of God, yes. No God, yeah.
Because God is reality. I am that I am. That's his name. God is in reality. If you want to touch God, you have to go to reality. How do you get away from God? You leave reality. To some extent, the farther you leave that reality, the farther you move from God. And so it would be better for someone in the city, because it's true, we can't all live in city in the country, and sadly, we can't all live in Texas. But it would be better for a child in a city to learn to sit down and look at ants on the ground and marvel. Like, they're incredible. Just my grandmother, who is a saint, she used to spend hours just...
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Walking, she would write me letters, just sitting down or walking and watching ants just work on a little anthill. You can go to the middle of downtown Detroit or in Chicago, and you can find anthills. You can find weeds that are growing, something with a flower that's growing through a crack. That's absolutely incredible. You can watch pigeons. Pigeons are profound. It's a little bit of heaven on earth. And so we need to nurture that love for reality. And part of that, now this is such an interesting thought that you made, that the death that's in it, death and fear and bigness, right? Because when are we going to experience God truly if we don't experience him in some place that shakes us? Because God is awesome and fearful and huge. And I always tell people coming into church, and in the Orthodox Church, there's a lot of emphasis on mystery. And people who are not acquainted with this form of ancient worship will come in sometimes and say, well, I don't know what was going on. And I usually tell them, that's great. You know, going to church for a worship service should be like standing on a mountaintop in a huge storm. You don't know what's happening, and it's scary. Something bigger than you is there, and it pulls you out of yourself. There's an ecstasis, right? An ecstatic moment of just encountering thou and wanting to fall on your knees. And also with death. I mean, talk about a death-fearing culture. Mm-hmm. And what is that doing to us? How is that affecting us and our children? I remember studying psychology.
You're saying that we're afraid of death.
We're afraid of death. That one of the worst things you can do to children is isolate them from death. From very early on, children should be exposed to death. And it does the opposite of what people think. I remember when my father died and my twins were maybe 3 or 4 years old. And we brought him up to the casket and they kissed their grandfather. And then I drew a little children's book that's not really worth showing anyone else, but we read it together. We talked about death and death and paradise and God and everything on the other side of death became real to them. Not just something parents talk about or should be talking about. It became real. And I think it gave them peace. Maybe it gave them a little fear, but in a good way. Mm-hmm. A sense of, wow, what I do in this earth matters. This is big.
Something about technology, it makes those kinds of things manageable.
Mm. Yeah.
I stand on top of Mount Everest. I don't have to be afraid because I know I'm not actually going to die.
Right.
But when I do stand on top of Mount Everest, then I get the full experience. And so in some ways we want all the safety and none of the risk of living. And we then forfeit the opportunity to be awestruck, and to be really awestruck in the sense of standing on a boat in the ocean and the storm's coming. This is all I do. I go, I don't know what's next. This could be the end. Yeah. And so we
steal that in some ways from ourselves and from our children.
Yeah, there's a lot of things there you've kind of opened up, and I think worth unpacking some more. You talk about bigness and mystery, and just butting up against something that is not manageable. So kind of going back again to the image of Yosemite that we've just had as a family, we read the books and it said, this is the tallest waterfall in the world. It's, you know, such and such 1,000 feet here, and there's a break, and you get all this descriptive language, this data. Again, there's not much use for that. There's no experience. But then we went there and we went on like a 7-mile hike up stone steps that were about, you know, 1.5 feet apart, you know, and the water and the waterfall and the mist is coming all over us, and the steps are slippery, and we're getting dehydrated, and we're not sure we're going to make it, and we're exhausted. And so it's one thing to say, yeah, it's big. And it's another thing to say, I'm exhausted. I don't know if I can make the end of this hike. And actually, all of us felt that way. At one point, I said to my wife, I said, maybe we made a mistake coming this way. We should have turned back a lot sooner. But we kind of trekked on. I mean, it was hard. But that butting against the bigness of the thing gives you a much more of a respect for the reality of it, again, than just the kind of data bites that we collect about this or that phenomena. There's so much going on there that you've brought up with reality and bigness and death and, you know, those things we can't manage, and the mystery of worship and the mystery of this world, that we can only encounter by getting into it.
I wonder if there's a degree of needing to suffer to really value something.
Yeah.
You know, you could watch a documentary or look at a picture book about something like that. But when you have to trek up the mountain and sweat and smack mosquitoes,
yeah,
and you make it, there's that aha moment. And in our own life, I mean, think about relationships. You know, we don't want to be vulnerable. There's such an epidemic of pornography now. Right. And I've been told that people aren't even dating, you know, because why bother? You know, it's so easy. You don't have to be vulnerable, but there's no, you know, with the vulnerability and the suffering, with the fact that if you're going to live with someone, it means you've dedicated everything. You've sacrificed yourself. Sometimes they're moody, sometimes they're cranky, and sometimes you're the one, maybe more than the other, that's moody and cranky. But you have to learn to forgive. You have to learn to persevere, and it becomes, you get that aha moment. You know, you experience through that suffering more appreciation. I once heard a story about a king. I won't tell the whole story, but that parable that a king went all over the world to find the best meal. And he traveled to all the great palaces, and finally, very despondent, he was ready to give up, but he was wandering through the forest and he found a lumberjack. And he told him, he said, I'm looking for the best meal in the world. And lumberjack said, I can make that for you. He says, you can? Tell me, how, where? He says, well, here, I'll show you later. Just take this axe. So start cutting some wood. So he started cutting wood, and they cut all day long. And he's exhausted and famished. And finally, he says, okay, will you show me the best meal? Yeah, I sure can. Takes him to his cabin, and he starts cooking. He's got a little stew, a cup of water. And the king cherished that meal unlike any meal he'd ever cherished. That was the best meal. And so somehow, again, that suffering is necessary for enjoying what's given to us.
I'm also fascinated by a lot of these topics we're covering today is centered around food.
Yeah.
I told my kids the other day, I said, the one of the reasons I would like to run more, exercise more, is so I could eat more.
It's not bad.
But food seems to be the center of a lot of these conversations today, as far as, you know, the gathering of around the table and
make food.
How to make food and the cost of food. Yeah, and the risk involved with the life involved, especially when you have animals. And what's really fascinated me is, again, there's a revelation of God's, you know, epiphany. There's epiphany there, even at the dinner table, when the Father takes the lead and blesses it. Because in that moment, your family is experiencing, in measure, communion. A communion one with another and with God's, grace through the food that he's given us. And so, yeah, food really is, it's fascinating. And, you know, when Alexander Schmemann, you know, points out, he's a great writer out there, especially writing on liturgics. But he said, you know, the first commandment had to do with food. Eat not of the food, the fruit in Eden, right? And that first sin was the taking of the food wrongly as an end to itself instead of as communion with God. It's really fascinating that, you know, this theme of food runs through it all because it's the most intimate communion with God, even to a person who's not a believer. Because when we eat of the earth, we're accepting that, you know, gift of God. And then, of course, in its apex in communion in church, where you have a spiritual gift of God's grace.
A few years ago, I remember sitting at the dinner table and I was going to say the grace before we ate. And I started praying in my head. I thought to myself, I think I said something like, thank you, God, for providing the food that we're about to eat. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but I remember thinking in my head, there might have been a bag of chips there. You know, and I'm thinking, this is confusing to a small kid. Because I'm like, wait, did God bring the bag of chips to the table? And there is something about being connected to food where I remember I don't remember if it's the same meal or later, I started praying something along the lines of, let's say we had, you know, chicken, fried chicken or something, you know, thank you, God, for providing the chicken who sacrificed its life so that we could then enjoy it here at the table. And that prayer seems many steps away because I live in a very processed culture. So I get the chicken at the store, right? Because even that's confusing. Thanks God for providing the chicken. Well, if I was a little kid, I'm like, you just went to the store and picked it up, right? But when you start to go all the way back, and you probably have this experience more than many, everything that we consume comes from what God had already created. The wheat in the fields. I mean, think how many things are made of wheat, sugar, and eggs and milk, almost everything we eat. And all those are from creatures that we did not create ourselves. And so, you know, being disconnected from reality makes us disconnected from the source of said reality and even the source of our food, which isn't ourselves. I didn't make the cow. I didn't make the chicken. Humans may have bred the chickens into some better version or a more tasty version, but we didn't make them or create them. And of course, then that begs the question, well, then who? And if we miss out on that part, many of us don't even get to the question of the who.
That's the whole point of everything, right? Experiencing the who. I mean, the whole point of eating, the reason God gave us food and designed us to eat is so that we could marvel at that who. We could enjoy it and in an act of communion and give thanks, praise him for making this. There's a love making that occurs when we eat, if we're eating in a prayerful way. Or anything, any work we do when we have to wash the dishes, where we should be doing this as though we're offering this to God. There's that person again in everything. And yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a real challenge. I mean, we found,
you know, even all the way back to tend and keep from Genesis, for God to tell it to Adam, right? That's God telling us what we're supposed to do.
And he's doing it for him. He's doing it for his boss. This is given to you. And, you know, Benjamin, you mentioned the first commandment having to do with food. And now think about how in the new covenant, God redeems that. We were damned by food, and now we're saved by food. Yeah. Unless you eat my body or blood, you shall have no life. Yeah. And what does Christ talk about the most when he refers to heaven? Food.
Yeah.
Just there's this summation and that's in food. And Father Alexander Schmemann, he also said that the entire world is a banquet table laid out for us by God for us to enjoy and give back thanks. So everything is about us taking it into us and then praising the giver of it. And for parenting, you know, food has to be the center. Just I always tell parishioners the altar is the centerpiece of our worship in the sanctuary. Well, the dining table is the altar of the home. Or if it's not, something else is. And it's usually hanging on a wall, flashing, right? But in a life that brings us back to the giver, there's that table is so important and enjoying that food. And of course, some days are better than others. Some days the kids don't want to eat or they throw it or something. And it's a struggle. There's a struggle to perform the liturgy of worship and the daily home.
But that gives a much bigger context to the encouragement to have family meals together, to eat dinner together. So oftentimes, I went to the homeschool conference not too long ago. I've interviewed some dads. The encouragement is eat dinner together, eat meals together. And that's good. But I think it does miss something because then you go, oh, sure, we'll eat meals together. And then families sit in front of the TV and eat meals together. Or we eat meals together, but we go through our tasks for the day, or we don't talk, or people look at their phones while they're eating, go to a restaurant and everyone's staring at their phones. They're eating together, sort of.
Yeah.
But it misses the whys and the reasons for doing it.
You know, I think there's a practical question there about how do fathers then consecrate meals in the home. Sometimes you have to eat on the run. Sometimes you guys are rushing out the door and it's just like, hey, let's just grab this bag of chips and take it in the car because we got to get to lessons or whatever, right? Those are realities that we kind of all struggle with as we're kind of sometimes our schedules kind of conquer us instead of us conquering our schedules. We were talking about on the way over today, you know. What we can do, what all of us can do is to plan and set aside particular meals, you know, and do them in such a way that it is a sacred act. Of course, it's going to be on major feast days. It's going to be at Christmas. It's going to be Thanksgiving. It's going to be Easter. It's going to be birthdays. You know, there's basic days that should be ritualistic meals, right? A ritualistic meal would mean like, we're going to put the tablecloth on. We're going to set the table. We're going to use plates and we're going to wash them afterward. And our dishwasher, we have a curse. This isn't a society. We have a curse. We always live somewhere with a broken dishwasher. And so we're again in a house with a broken dishwasher. So we have to wash our dishes by hand, which honestly, we probably don't do very well or very regularly because we all get tired of washing dishes. But last night we had a birthday party and, you know, it was really great because several of us got together and started washing the dishes. And so this whole process of setting the tablecloth, cooking the meal, not the bag of chips, and, you know, especially choosing special meals, like specific things, like, we will always have salmon on March 25th because that's the day that we remember that the angel came to Mary and declared, you're blessed among women. And so we always have salmon on that day. And so it's something that we all anticipate. Everybody's like, oh, it's the 25th of March. We're going to have salmon tonight. The kids remember. We remember. You know, and most families have Thanksgiving turkey every year. I was with a group of people who one year said, hey, let's just get Chinese takeout for Thanksgiving. And my wife and I were like, what do you mean? You're supposed to have a turkey. This is what's done. And so we volunteered to provide the turkey because we were so adamant. You got to have the turkey. You know, whether or not it matters that you have a turkey.
You got the Chinese buffet for Thanksgiving Day.
You actually did one year because we were traveling Thanksgiving Day. So, you know, sometimes you can do what you got to do. Actually, we went to Hawaii once and we had pork. Because it was like a luau on Thanksgiving Day. Yeah, so you do what you can. So it's not that it's turkey that makes it special. But the point is that it's a ritual. The point is that this is what our family does. If your family does Chinese takeout on, probably better cook it, just keep, you know, in line with all we've been saying. But if your experience in your family is like, hey, we're going to make stir fry every Thanksgiving, great, make stir fry, but it needs to be stir fry every year. So there's an anticipation, there's an excitement, there's a consecration of the day saying, this is the day we have stir fry. This is the day we have salmon. This is the day we have turkey. And it means something. And it doesn't mean something just because, but because this day is set apart. This is Thanksgiving. This is a birthday. This is Christmas. And these are really, really powerful ways we form the hearts of our children so that when they are adults, they'll remember. They'll remember the smells, the tastes, the tablecloth. Mom always brought out those dishes on that day. We were allowed a sip of, you know, sparkling grape juice that day or whatever. You know, whatever that tradition in your family is, they're going to grow up. And, you know, part of this conversation began with, you know, how do we inculcate on the children the loves of the things we want them to grow up and continue to love? And establishing these rituals around the table is one way, because they're going to grow up, they're going to have their family, and they'll be like, oh, it's Christmas. We need to do that thing we always did. You know, and the more senses you can involve in that at the meal, more senses involved in the dinner table than any other ritual you can have in your household. The more senses you involve, the more they're going to remember, the more they're going to love, the more likely that tradition will continue. And this is a really, really significant way that we can, I believe, form the hearts of our children and you know, hope they'll return to those things when they get older.
You mentioned the love. And that was actually something I was just thinking of right now, is that you mentioned the things you really love is what your children will see. And that's was your experience in your own family growing up. I did a talk recently where I used this idea of Zeitgeist. You heard Zeitgeist? But I called it Heimgeist. It's like a spirit of the home. And it's hard to define because so is Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist is this substance, this atmosphere. It's the things you really love, the things the culture really loves. And so in the home, same idea. It's the things we really love, the things we really care about, the heart direction. What are we really pointing towards? And we, most of us, can assent to what we ought to be pointed towards, but we often don't live actually pointed towards those things. Maybe we're over here, maybe we're a little bit over here. And one typical example would be, I put my family first, but I don't spend any time with them because I'm at work all day long. And I come home very late, and nothing against staying at work late necessarily, but the idea that we could assent to putting our family first, but really our family is maybe second or third after work and ourselves and our own aspirations and our own career goals. So my question in that is, when we come back to the idea of reality and living in reality, and what are our loves, what are our real loves, how do we love what's right and good? How do we really love what's right and good, not just say we love what's right and good?
Yeah, I have a brief story. A friend of mine a long time ago told me a story. His son said, Dad, what's a value? I don't know how the word came up. What does it mean to value something? And he said, oh, well, when you value something, you spend time with it, you think about it, you know, you talk about it. And he said, oh, you mean like your computer? And and my friend was very, very humbled by this. And so really our modeling as fathers in particular just has such a profound importance on that. And so it's something that we all, I mean, it's a great question. You know, how do we show what we really ought to be loving and valuing? And it really does start with the father more than anything else.
Yeah, the things that are caught, not taught.
Yeah.
Right. And how do we, I would also assent that it's by the power of the Holy Spirit that we're changed to really love the right things. But so oftentimes that's also, it's tricky to see that in ourselves. I can say I love something, and then I maybe realize months or years later, I don't, maybe I was loving the wrong thing.
So how do you fall in love with someone? How do you fall in love? You spend time staring in their eyes. If you stare in someone's eyes.
Maybe I am in love with my computer.
There's something about staring in someone's eyes. So a priest and a man I respect very deeply once told me and my wife that we needed to go on a date every week. And we haven't been completely successful. We have seasons where we go on dates every week, and then times where, you know, weeks go by and we realize we've lost it. But one thing we started doing, because it wasn't always realistic to go out of the home, we have a little table just big enough for two in our bedroom, and we lock the door so the kids can't get in. We put a tablecloth, like you said. We light a candle in the center of the table, maybe some flowers if we have them, and we have a quiet meal. And there's something so restorative. You're just coming centered together to just look at each other's eyes. It can be 15 minutes long, but it just brings us back together. And I think we love what we spend time just cherishing, taking in. You know, I've often wondered when people tell me that, you know, that, well, they're too busy to go to church on Sunday. I think, you know, your greatest act of worship is demonstrated by how you spend your time. What are you doing on the first day of the week? If you're going to church, it's an act. It's using your body and hopefully your soul, but usually the soul follows the body. And it's coming and saying, God, you are first. But if we don't go to church on a Sunday, who are we worshiping? Something. Whatever we do at the beginning of the week, that is what we worship. And it's the same thing with our loves. Who are we spending time with? Are we coming together with a candle, with something beautiful, something that helps us to get in the zone of appreciating a person? And it's the same thing with our families, too.
Before you go on, describe to me, so when do you do this?
Usually in a weekday.
You just pick a time.
We pick a time. We try once a week. We usually Thursdays, what works for my schedule. Tonight, when I get home, I'm taking my wife out. And like I said, if we don't have any time, if we have 30 minutes or an hour, and we'll find some time in the week, and we'll just try to be intentional at just enjoying one another, listening to one another, looking at each other's eyes, and just hearing one another. Like I said, the profound insight that can come from just looking at a ant or looking at a little flower. If we can learn what the classicists call leisure, and I would love to hear some of your thoughts about this, because I think it's an important part of this topic of love. Leisure, learning to gaze and contemplate, not necessarily in a strained effort to understand, but in a sense of opening up your soul to reach for that which is behind. And that's what you see in people's eyes. As soon as you look in someone's eyes, it's daunting.
I heard a marriage book, or I read a marriage book, and one of its recommendations was to look into your wife's eyes for 2 minutes and just stare at each other for 2 minutes. You don't have to say anything. You don't do anything. Yeah. Just look. And I remember Karina and I, we've only done it a couple of times, but I remember I remember the first time we did it, you know, you start staring, and then after a couple of minutes, you sort of feel like I should look away, but I'm going to keep looking. And then you start feeling a little bit like,
It's very vulnerable.
It is. It is very vulnerable. That's right.
I always hate bringing it up in a conversation, because then all of a sudden,
you're aware of what you're looking at.
It's vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because we all know, everyone knows when they look in someone's eyes that something enormous, something huge is right there. Mm. Right. And so, and coming back to loves, and what are we loving? You know, what is, we, worship and love is closely connected, right? And our lifestyle, our rituals, those are what foster our loves.
Yeah.
The focal points in our life, the magnets that draw our attention, that whether it's not intentional, in which case usually it's a screen that has the most powerful magnetic pull in a spiritual level. And so our loves very easily get sucked into that. But if we can be intentional, and I like that, I'm thinking about that same, and I'm getting hungry, actually. You know, there's a pull to that when you're excited about a certain meal. My wife and her mother grew up celebrating a Russian tradition and on Christmas Eve of eating the Christ loaf. And there's a few meals that we eat. And there's something all year round that I look forward to that. It's a magnet, mm-hmm. that tradition, or the Christmas tree, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to be so intentional and careful about constantly checking what are the magnets in our life. And I think those magnets, those focal practices and focal points, that's what will cultivate our loves.
So we talked about reality. We've talked about loves and that time and loves are closely intricate, worship closely linked. And you mentioned that you were interested in hearing about leisure.
Yes. You introduced me to it, so I'm putting you on the spot.
Oh. Is this like leisure versus entertainment, or?
That's the question.
Okay.
Right.
That needs to be fleshed out.
Yeah. I feel like lately I haven't been very good at this, so I'm feeling a little bit on the spot in that sense. But yeah, you know, leisure is what you do when you don't have to do it. Or I guess Tom Sawyer said that, right? Tom Sawyer was painting the white fences, you know, whitewashing the fences, and he convinced everybody it was the best thing because he's like, oh, you don't want to do this. I get to do this. I get to do this, he told his, you know, buddies when he was punished to go whitewash the fence. And he started convincing all these guys, like, he's like, well, we kind of want to try. He said, no, I'm not going to let you try whitewashing this fence. I said, well, here, I'll give you this, you know, and this is like the 1800s. They got broken sticks and rocks and, you know, little treasures. So Tom Sawyer ends up getting his friends to give him these little treasures, and then they whitewash the fence. And the conclusion was, work is what you have to do. And I don't remember if he used the word leisure or not, but leisure is the thing that you get to do. It's the thing you don't have to do. So that's good. The only problem is sometimes what we've done is we've replaced the you don't have to do it into just entertainment. Okay, so what's the difference there? The difference there is that entertainment, I don't know if I can make a really clear distinction, but I think the simple way to say it is entertainment is passive. Leisure is something you're actually doing. So it could be whitewashing that fence. You know, it could be, you know, slaughtering the pig as a community, you know, and have a big cookout, you know, even though that's work in the sense that we're doing it together. But in our day and age, it is leisure. Because we don't have to do that. We could go to the store and just go buy bacon. It'd be a lot easier. But it can turn into leisure if the community's coming together around this, you know, what we might call work and slaughtering the pig for a meal together to share. It becomes communion. In schools, you know, I try to convince my students that this isn't work. It's a real bad habit teachers have and students have and parents who homeschool have. Do your work. Well, it's not work. You know, a liberal arts education is leisure in that you don't have to do it. It's not something that children have to do to get a roof over their head. It's not something children have to do to, you know, get a meal on their plate. They have the leisure to learn. So leisure has to do with something you pursue. Let's say that.
We certainly used that terminology in our house.
Yeah.
Do your schoolwork.
My kids have heard work enough, and I've used the term work enough, that when I do say, this isn't work, this is leisure, sometimes I am.
Whatever, Dad.
Yeah. But anyway, this may be proof in the pudding right here, though, because my kids did attend private school for a few years, which had a very heavy homework load, and they were stressed out about it. We're homeschooling now again. And I told them regularly, just don't do your homework, because grades weren't that important to me. Don't do your homework. You don't have to do your homework. I'm not going to make you do your homework. My kids did their homework so dutifully, and I never once told them, you better do your homework. In fact, they got excellent grades, and I never even showed them report cards. They start begging me for the report cards because I didn't go over them with them. Because I just like, no, you know, I told them again and again, kids, I don't care about your grades. I care about your learning. I want you to love learning. But I told my children again and again, I don't care about schooling. I don't care about your grades. I don't care about your homework. Imagine blatantly have told that to my children on a regular basis. Well, the result was that while they're in that school, they all dutifully did their homework and they all got very good grades. But I never, ever asked that of them. So it became something that they pursued and they didn't have to. So that might be the best definition of leisure, that which you pursue when you don't have to. Watching a movie is not leisure most of the time because you're not pursuing anything. It doesn't demand anything.
Well, and if anything, it gives you a false sense of accomplishment without even accomplishing it.
And by the way, I don't think all entertainment is always bad. I think sometimes it's good to have a little entertainment in life. I think it's important in its own way.
You've talked a little bit about the moral imagination in entertainment.
You can, you know, So is there entertainment that can be good or useful? Yes, I think so. I think that these days, that is a very difficult question because there's so much bad entertainment.
And when you say bad, you mean morally bad, or
could be morally bad entertainment that could be negative also, is just completely passive. Just no, I think you can have entertainment that has a redeeming value. I have one guilty pleasure, right? You know, we don't have television, but we do watch DVDs. We'll watch movies. Probably too much. I'm getting convicted here. I feel like, oh man, I do need to smash our TV. Maybe we watch too many movies. But I've been very, very particular about which movies that I think are maybe good or useful for my children. However, I have one guilty pleasure, and it's the Lego Movie, because there is absolutely nothing redeeming in that movie at all. It's pure entertainment. And I boldly will pronounce that. Yes, we have watched the Lego Movie. It's pure raw entertainment. But, you know, what's more, as far as entertainment goes, I think it's better to find something that the whole family can enjoy, which is hard. Very difficult. I have six children from 6 to, well, now 19. So I have a very wide range. It's very difficult to find that entertainment that's fitting for the whole family. We really liked, what was that called? All Creatures Great and Small. It's like a BBC series. Yeah, that was a great family series. That was entertainment. It's not leisure, but something that we could all enjoy together, that has redeeming qualities in the characters. And he's a vet in the early, I think, the 1930s, 1940s. It's based on a true story that may or may not matter. And he takes care of animals, and, you know, they're trying to be good people. And, you know, it's not bad. Leisure is more important. And it's something that, yes, I'm convicted just from this conversation. We need to kind of emphasize that more. Evening leisure might look like reading something together. And I think there's a difference between watching a film and reading, is because you have to pursue the meaning in the words. It requires something of your own imagination. There's a little bit more work involved. That is also difficult when you have a wide range of children. I think we started reading less as a family, as my older children became teenagers, and my younger ones, you know, they couldn't process the same things. So there's definitely challenges. I don't know.
Is that helpful?
Well, yes, in many ways. Sure. And I have many more questions. It's a difficult topic to flesh out. Leisure,
yes.
Entertainment, and
how
everything
much
around
you...
that, and, mm-hmm. and what is what. So Joseph Pieper wrote one of the most famous books on this topic called Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Yeah. It's a book, it's a must read, just incredible work. And I think maybe the most important philosophical work in the 20th century. And however much I've studied this book, he doesn't give a definition of leisure.
Oh, no.
Because it's difficult to put your hands on. There's a lot to it. And so I've heard people, and I can imagine many responding and say, oh, well, you're saying, you know, TV, you're not really interacting. So video games must be better. But it's just the opposite. In fact, I think it's more dangerous because it's sucking. You're interacting, but there's something that's happening that's different than leisure, where... according to Pieper's definition, and he's drawing from the Greek philosophers as well as the classical and scholastic philosophers in Christendom, leisure has more to do with contemplation and enjoyment. It's like, yeah. I think of the word Sabbath, which means in Hebrew, Sabbath, to rest and to delight in. So there's a sense in leisure, you're entering into something meaningful, something almost outside of time. You're tapping into something that's not just, like you said, it's not just why utilitarian. I have to do this. It's, I'm a human. I get to just be a human and just paint or whatever it is. I often go back in my mind.
It's also not just doing something, being engaged in something.
No, it's not just doing something. There's
contemplation is a good word. I think that's a...
Because you mentioned passive versus active.
Yeah.
But you could be active in video games, as you mentioned, or
just
virtual reality.
Video games are really a problem, though, because it's such a narrowing of the scope of the mind. I have this argument, when I've taught in public school as well as private. And in a public school, I had this debate with a student who was explaining, oh, when I play video games, I can do anything. I can, you know, blah, blah. I said, actually,
I have friends.
Meaning he could jump high mountain.
Climb, you know, he could be Spider-Man. He can climb a, you know, building or whatever. I mean, we didn't get specific. And I tried to argue the opposite.
I said, well, no, actually, it's narrowing the scope of what you're accomplishing. It's a really, really fantastic article. Forgive me, I can't remember the author at this time, about play and how play has transformed a child's, I'm sorry, how in the last several decades, the way we as a culture have defined play and offered play to children has been a limitation of the scope of their own self-government, and therefore a limitation of their own self-control and attention spans. And so the experiment was done, and this is pretty obvious, I think, nowadays in the 1950s, if you just told a child, stand there, just don't do anything, just stay there. And they could do it almost indefinitely by a certain age, whereas you do that same experiment several decades later, and, I mean, you're lucky if they can stand still and have demonstrate self-control for 60 seconds. In this particular article, he was tracing this back to the history of toys. And he explained that the first time they marketed toys on television, he gave the exact date. It was called like the Bumbo Gun. I don't know. It was a toy nobody remembers. But the point is that it was a toy being marketed to children, that is what play is. Okay. So let's follow this for a sec. You mentioned playing with dirt and sticks, and that's the best thing. Yeah, absolutely. So if your kid finds a stick, that stick can be a snake, a staff, a sword, baseball bat, a spear. It could be anything that the child imagines it. And so the child, when he interacts, especially with other children, they're going to start defining the boundaries of their own world, their own game, their own play. And they narrate their own stories as they're playing that game with a stick. Flash forward, we're in the 1950s, and now the stick isn't a stick, it's a wooden sword. So now we've limited the scope of the play, and that sword, that wooden sword, has embedded in it a script that tells the students, the children, what they ought to be doing. And so now the sword is a sword. It's no longer a snake, it's no longer a staff. Some kids will still do that, but the majority of the time, they'll default back to the sword. So now they've just defined their role. You are a knight or some other soldier or some sort of character that uses a sword. Flash forward in the 1970s, now the sword's a lightsaber. And so now there's literally a script involved, and the script's completely created by adults. And Luke, you're my father. Oh, no, my hand. They shove their hand inside of their shirt, and they're Luke Skywalker. And they even know the lines. And so an adult is now governing them. An adult is telling them, this is what you ought to be playing at. And the child is not governing and creating the rules for their own play. So back to the video games. Video game, we've taken to a whole new level, where not only is the toy given to them and the script is given to them, but they're just doing this with their fingers, right? And they're even told what they look like. You know, maybe they can make a selection, but there's still a limited scope of what they can look like as they pick their avatar, right? And the world is completely created by some adult somewhere, and the child plays in this adult's world. And so I've tried to explain this to young people, that when you play a video game, you're not doing anything. You're not creating the world. You're not imagining it. You're not creating the limits. You're not creating anything that a child with a stick knows how to create. One of the repercussions of this is children don't learn self-government, which is directly related to problems with self-control and attention spans, which is kind of epidemic in our age. So that's kind of an aside, but it goes back into the whole...
No, that's very interesting that we've... And even the idea of that the child is playing in an adult's world.
Yes.
I think that's really interesting. And you see that. I mean, you see that in cartoons. We were watching something, or I saw... I can't remember what it was, but I remember thinking to myself, this was created by grown men and women, but it was... for like a little kid.
This is my reaction to that. Okay, the kid is playing according to a man's world, but which man?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. It's not your father.
It's not you.
Your priest. It's not Jesus.
Right.
It's this whole industry that is doing everything it can to get your money. Mm. Right? I mean, we're talking, you know, so far removed from home. And so how is that shaping you? What image is that impressing onto your heart? And it sounds similar to, but it's the complete antithesis to what we were talking about before, about how children are supposed to be interacting in the family all together, that they're not to be isolated, that it's meaningful, that they're that they're growing to be full persons, right? Adults, if you will, in nobility. But it's very different. It's a sort of a fake version of that. This focus on play is fascinating to me, I think, because and it's connected to leisure and entertainment and these concepts of how we're using our time. And I often remember something a missionary once told me from Alaska. He knows the divine liturgy, the worship service in the Orthodox Church in three languages of the indigenous peoples of Alaska. And he flies around little planes and he goes around. And he was talking once about how they have a very different orientation to time and the use of their time. That we in America, we have a very heavy dichotomy between work and play, or really work and escapism is essentially what it is. But he said for the indigenous peoples of Alaska, the focus is sacred time. There is no dichotomy. It's not, well, now I'm working and well, now I can party. It's everything is ritualized and meaningful, and it's everything connects with their ancestry and with divinity, and there's a sense of entering into the moment. Whether it's playing or it's working, they don't really think of it as two different things. And just like you said with school, which is really helpful, you know, when we think of school as, well, this is work. Well, okay, well, I got to go do my work and then I can play, as opposed to this is part of these exercises that I have before me, these books, this is part of my celebrating and working with this meaningful universe that God has given me so that I can give him glory. They're just very, very different ways of thinking, but hard to parse out.
But our culture is a conundrum because all these things are, you know, proffered as normal. What we're trying to do, I think, on all of our lives, I know as fathers, is trying to kind of recover something that's actually normal in terms of what it means to be human, which is why I like spending time with both of you.
Yeah. I underlined a part in this book. This is Rory Groves' book, The Family Economy. And we didn't talk a lot about work specifically, but we did in what you just mentioned, you know, work, play, leisure. But he says something here that's, I think, a great sort of summary of some of the things we've talked about. I was not merely a means to a paycheck. I think a lot of men in our culture feel like that. I'm just here to get money so that then we can have nice things. I was the pater familias, the head of the household, responsible for the entirety of my family's well-being, physical, spiritual, and economic felt to me. I needed direction. I needed direction to lead my family and sought God to supply it. And that's what we're trying to do here. And the other thing I wanted to mention, and we can close with this, this is someone who wrote the afterword of this book, Alan Carlson, and they wrote a family manifesto, and the has 4 points. We will build a new culture of marriage, and that's simply new, not because it's new, but because it's been lost and needs to be refound. We will build a new culture of marriage. We will welcome and celebrate more babies and larger families. We will find ways to bring mothers, fathers, and children back home, and we will create true home economies. And I just think that's such a powerful just idea that families can actually live their lives together. They don't have to be separated and apart. But I think it starts with thinking about reality and love and how we think about work and play, and that those things don't have to be so segregated, that all those things in their right place are worshipful to God and meaningful for humans. So. Thank you guys for being here today.
Thank you, Ethan.
We could talk for hours, and maybe we will another day. So thank you all.
Fellow fathers and friends, so glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.